Hosea 1, verse 1. The word of the Lord came to Hosea, son of Beeri, during the reigns of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, and during the reign of Jeroboam, son of Jehoash, king of Israel. So Hosea is the son of Beeri. We don't really know anything more about him. The name Hosea is the root for the word to deliver or to save. And so if you took and you added to Hosea the Yah, which is the stands for Yahweh, the Lord, you would have Yehoshua, and you would basically have the name of Joshua or the name of Jesus. So the name of the prophet indicates salvation or deliverance. And notice that he's prophesying during the reigns of these four kings of Judah: Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. So he's prophesying during the same time that Isaiah and Micah and probably Amos was prophesying. But Hosea's ministry is mainly to the northern kingdom. So the northern kingdom, there was the division of the nation that took place after the reign of Solomon under Jeroboam the first and Rehoboam. The nation was split in two. And so you had the 10 northern kingdoms that are referred to as Israel, or also referred to as Ephraim. We'll see that Ephraim is used frequently in Hosea. And then you have the southern kingdom of Judah. And so although Judah is referenced here in Hosea, the bulk of the message is to the northern kingdom. And so this is before the northern kingdom goes into captivity to Assyria. So if you remember the history, the northern kingdom falls first to the Assyrians in 721. And then it's not till 586 that the southern kingdom falls to Babylon. So here we are. We are here in kind of really what would have been the golden years of the nation of Israel. Golden years in the sense of it was a time of prosperity. It was a time of a lot of national successes and things of that nature. But all the while, the northern kingdom was in rebellion to the Lord. So out of all of the kings in the north, you do not have a single king that really walked with the Lord. Every one of them were living in rebellion of one kind or another. Where in the southern kingdom, you have a handful of righteous kings, but not so in the northern kingdom. So this is during the reign of Jeroboam, and this is Jeroboam the second. Jeroboam the first was the first king over the northern kingdom. So the first three chapters are really about the prophet and his experience. And then from chapter 4 to 14 are basically all a long statement of judgment that's going to come. Now, the thing that we're going to see here with Hosea is that he was a prophet in that he preached to the northern kingdom. He was what you call a writing prophet. He wrote this. Not all prophets wrote things, like Elijah, for example, did not write anything. Elisha did not write anything. So he's a vocal, he's a voice to the northern kingdom. He's writing this prophecy, but what we're going to see is that his life is an illustration It's a prophetic illustration as well. And sometimes God would use the lives of his servants to speak things. And on the positive side of things, you think of somebody like Abraham. So God uses the life of Abraham and a particular act in Abraham's life to speak about his love and about his redemptive plan. So remember when Abraham took Isaac up on to the top of Mount Moriah, and there he was to offer up Isaac. And he ended up, of course, being told not to do that. But there you have this whole thing being acted out where the father, Abraham, takes his only son, Isaac — that's the specific terminology that's used — his only son whom he loves, and he offers him on a mountain. And so Abraham becomes a picture of God the Father. Isaac becomes a picture of God the Son. So in a similar matter, but in a much different way, Hosea is now going to, he's going to act out through his life experience what is happening between God and his people. And so, in verse 2, when the word of the Lord began to speak through Hosea, the Lord said to him, "Go marry a promiscuous woman and have children with her." Promiscuous woman. The literal wording here is marry a woman of harlotry. So some translations here read prostitute. That is really actually a good translation of what is being said. Take a woman who is a prostitute and marry her. That's the command that God is giving to Hosea here. Marry a promiscuous woman and have children with her. And here it is: for like an adulterous wife, this land is guilty of unfaithfulness to the Lord. So he married Gomer, daughter of Diblaim, and she conceived and bore a son. Now, this is obviously a very unique situation. You know, there are a few times where the prophets were commanded by God to do strange things. Isaiah was to go around for a long period of time with his buttocks exposed. And that was the message that God was sending to the people. Just like Isaiah is going around with his buttocks exposed, I'm going to expose the land of Judah. And, you know, so that was kind of strange, right? And Ezekiel had to, he had to lay on one side for X amount of days, and then he had to turn over and lay on the other side. And then he had to make bread, and he was initially told to use dung, poop. He was told to use that. He's like, "Oh, Lord, please don't make me use that." And, you know, God relented and in the end let him use, I think it was cow dung or something that he let him use. But and so, you know, these are weird things. But they were ways that God was illustrating things. And so this is a weird, unusual command of God. I mean, in one sense, if Hosea fell in love with a prostitute and wanted to marry her, there's nothing that would say that he couldn't do that. He wasn't a priest or anything like that. The priests were forbidden from marrying prostitutes, but the average person, you know, maybe he fell in love with her or something. So that wouldn't necessarily have been wrong for him just to do that. But with God commanding him to do that, it just strikes us as that's bizarre. But again, God is going to use this whole thing, as we can see, as an illustration of what's happening between himself and the nation of Israel. Now, Cheryl reminded me of this today, and it was already a thought that I had in my mind. Many, many years ago, there was someone that she knew that was a Christian, but insisted that they could date non-Christian girls because God told Hosea to go and marry a prostitute. So when he was kind of called out on, like, hey, you know, what are you doing? These girls aren't believers and you're going out with them. He said, hey, I'm just doing what Hosea did, man. So I'm only telling that to just say that is not the way we understand Hosea. This is not a permission to go and date unbelievers if you're a Christian who is single. So now that we cleared that up, let's move on. And so then the Lord said to Hosea, he married Gomer, daughter of Diblaim, as we saw, and she conceived and bore him a son. Then the Lord said to Hosea, call him Jezreel, because I will soon punish the house of Jehu for the massacre at Jezreel, and I will put an end to the kingdom of Israel. In that day, I will break Israel's bow in the valley of Jezreel. So Jehu was a previous king, and he had slaughtered people, and so now judgment was going to come. And then verse 6 says, Gomer conceived again and gave birth to a daughter. The Lord said to Hosea, call her Lo-Ruhamah, which means not loved. For I will no longer show love to Israel, that I should at all forgive them. Yet I will show love to Judah, and I will save them not by bow, sword, or battle, or by horses or horsemen, but I, the Lord their God, will save them. So you see, as I said earlier, the judgment of Israel is near. The judgment of Judah is out in the future. So God is still going to work with Judah, try to bring Judah around to repentance and faith. So the time for their judgment hasn't come. And so next he says, after she weaned Lo-Ruhamah, Gomer had another son. Then the Lord said, call him Lo-Ami, which means not my people. So you see God sending a message even through the names of these children. Not my people, for you are not my people, and I am not your God. So here's where God is breaking his relationship with Israel because of their continued rebellion against him. So he says, you are not my people. And then it goes on and says, in the place where it was said to them, you are not my people, they will be called the children of the living God. So this, we've seen this many times in the prophets already, right? We see that God will bring a word of judgment, and he will then bring a word of hope. So the judgment for Israel is going to be severe, but there's also hope, because there will be a time of restoration that will come. So in the place where it was said to them, you are not my people, there they will be called the sons of the living God. Paul quotes this in Romans chapter 10. And in Romans 9 through 11, maybe you've read that yourself, or if you haven't read it and you do read it, those chapters have to do with Paul is explaining why it is that the people of God, the Jewish people, the people of Israel, why it is that they have not believed in Jesus as the Messiah, and why it is that God has rejected them. And in Paul's explanation, he uses passages from various prophets, but he uses this passage here from Hosea as well. And he declares that there's coming a day in the future, and this is still yet future, there's coming a day in the very place where they were told that they were not the people of God, in that place they will then be told again they are the people of God. And so Israel has been set aside. Israel has been replaced by the church, but not permanently. Israel has been replaced by the church temporarily. And so there's coming a day. So right now, you know, this is hard for us to understand because we love Israel. We, of course, we connected to Israel through the Bible. Many of us have gone to Israel and spent much time there, and we have an affection for Israel and the people, and we want to see them prosper. We want to see them do well and so forth. But, you know, the truth of the matter is this statement right here is still true of them today. You are not my people. They are today not God's people. They will be called again the children of the living God in the future. But today, you are God's people. We are God's people. The church is God's people today. And so that's something that there's confusion over this in the minds of people. So it's good that we understand that. And so he says, the people of Judah, so again, he's talking about the future. The people of Judah and the people of Israel will come together. They will appoint one leader and will come up out of the land, for great will be the day of Jezreel. Now, we saw that the name Loruamah means not love. Loami means not my people. Jezreel means planted. And so what God's saying here is in that day, there will be the great day of Jezreel. In that day, in the future, it will be the time when God plants them forever in the land, never to be removed again. That's the promise that's being given here to the people. And so the people of Judah and the people of Israel will come together. So again, the nation has been divided since the time of just after Solomon. And it's still yet in the future when the nation comes back together under the Lord. So now the second chapter is dealing more with the judgments that are going to come upon the nation. So Israel, the punishment and the restoration. So say to your brothers, my people, and your sisters, my loved one. So you're not loved, say you're loved. You're not my people, say you're my people. Now, he goes on in verse 2 and he says, rebuke your mother, rebuke her, for she is not my wife and I am not her husband. And so as we go down through this, this is the Lord using the analogy of the husband and wife and speaking about the nation and why it is that he's setting them aside, or why it is that he's rejecting them, or why it is that they're no longer loved because of their, as we've said, their continual adultery. So God sees this unfaithfulness on the part of the nation to him. He sees this in the same way that Hosea would see Gomer as she was an unfaithful wife. Now, in the first chapter, we see he takes her out of prostitution and marries her. She has children. But as we go on, we're going to see that she commits adultery, even after she was rescued out of the prostitution and, you know, brought in and made the wife and had the children. Then she goes back to adultery. Chapter 3 tells us that. And that is where we have this picture of what Israel does. So just here in the second chapter, I don't want to read the whole chapter, but I want to highlight a few things. So just look at verse 13 really quick. I will punish her for the days she burned incense to the Baals. So Baal was the regional god that was the god of fertility. And so the people of the land worshiped Baal, and they believed that, like, the land's productivity, agriculturally speaking, they believed that Baal was responsible for that. And because Baal and Asherah were fertility gods and goddesses, there was actually a sexual component that was part of the worship ceremony of Baal. So when the people engaged in Baal worship, which was their way of securing agricultural blessing, they did this through sexual acts, perverse sexual acts. They were performing on behalf of Baal to guarantee that they would have a fruitful harvest. So this is what the nations did, and this is what the Israelites embraced. And so they turned away from trusting God, who gave them the land, God who they would have understood if they remembered from their own scripture, God who made the world and everything in it, God who made the trees. And, you know, God was the one who said he's going to give them a land that's flowing with milk and honey and so forth. But they forsook the Lord and they followed after the nations and they worshiped Baal. So that's what he's talking about when he says, I will punish her for the day she burned incense to the Baals. Now, verse 14, therefore, I am now going to allure her and I will lead her into the wilderness and speak tenderly to her. Then I will give her back vineyards. So we see again, it's almost like as soon as God pronounces the judgment on Israel, he immediately comes back and says, but I'm going to bless in the end. I mean, this is the kind of love that God has. And the further we go here, I mean, it's we're just going to see how intense this is. And the analogy that God's using between a man and a woman, a husband and a wife, God is the husband in this. And what you see is his unfailing love, despite the thanklessness and the infidelity and the disregard for his love, that it doesn't stop him from loving. And so as soon as the judgment comes out of his mouth, he immediately turns around and says, I'm going to lead her into the wilderness. I'm going to speak tenderly to her. There I will give her back vineyards. I will make the valley of Achor a door of hope. The word Achor means trouble. I will make the valley of trouble a door of hope. There she will respond as in the days of her youth, as in the days she came up out of Egypt. In that day, declares the Lord, you will call me my husband. You will no longer call me my master. I will remove the names of the Baals from your lips. No longer will their names be invoked. In that day, I will make a covenant for them. The beast of the field, the birds of the air, the sky, the creatures that move along the ground. Bow and sword and battle I will abolish from the land so that all may lie down in safety. I will betroth you to me forever. I will betroth you in righteousness and justice, in love and in compassion. So the promise basically is God would take them back. And so I will betroth you in faithfulness and you will acknowledge the Lord. In that day, I will respond, declares the Lord. I will respond to the skies. They will respond to the earth and the earth will respond to the grain, the new wine, the olive oil. They will respond to Jezreel. I will plant her for myself in the land. I will show my love to the one I called not my loved one. I will say to those called not my people, you are my people, and they will say, you are my God. Now think about this. This is 700 years before the time of Jesus. And of course, as we said, they would go into the Assyrian captivity, and then Judah would go into the Babylonian captivity. Only Judah would return to the land after 70 years. The northern kingdom never really did return. There was no, massive migration back to the land from the northern kingdom. They remained scattered throughout the nation. Some made their way back. And then you have them in the land. during the Persian period, during the Greek period, during the Roman period. And during the Roman period, of course, that's when the Messiah comes. And they reject the Messiah. And now for 2,000 years, the children of Israel have been separated from God. And that is crazy to think of. That's 2,700 years that they have been out of this covenantal relationship, which ended totally and finally at the rejection of Jesus. So these promises are the promises that God has made about their ultimate end. Now, there are many people today, and even Christians, who do not believe that there is a future for Israel. They believe that Jewish people can be saved, and they believe that Jewish people will be part of the you know, God's in God's kingdom and all part of that. But the distinct national identity is forever gone. It's a thing of the past. But you know, every time I hear people say that, I just think, how can you possibly read these prophets and come to that conclusion? You have to just kind of ignore what they're saying, because God is saying to them, I mean, you know, you're not my people, but in the future, I'm going to call you my people. He's talking to a specific group of people that he promises to call them once again his people. Now, in a minute, we'll see this is even more clarified. So look at chapter 3. The Lord said to me, go show your love to your wife again, though she is loved by another man and is an adulteress. Love her as the Lord loves the Israelites, though they turn to other gods and love the sacred raisin cakes. So I bought her, this is Hosea, I bought her for 15 shekels of silver and about a homer and a lethek of barley. Then I told her, you are to live with me many days. You must not be a prostitute or be intimate with any man, and I will behave the same way toward you. Now, here's the parallel. For the Israelites will live many days without king or prince, without sacrifice or sacred stones, without ephod or household gods. Afterward, the Israelites will return and seek the Lord their God and David their king. They will come trembling to the Lord and to his blessings in the last days. So look at what this is saying. The Israelites will live many days without a king or a prince. So we saw, right at the end of Jeremiah, we saw how they went into captivity. And there has not been a king sitting on the throne of David since then. No king has sat on the throne of David since then. So many days without a king. Yes, many, many, many days without a king. But then many days without a sacrifice. Now, the sacrifice ended with the destruction of the temple by Nebuchadnezzar. But remember, the people returned to the land, rebuilt the temple, and resumed the sacrifices. And so the sacrifices continued, but then they also ended with the destruction of the temple in 70 AD by the Romans. So the Israelites will go many days without a sacrifice. And so how many days? Well, 2,000 years so far they've gone without a sacrifice. But notice also sacred stones, an ephod, and household gods. So this is interesting, because the sacred stones The ephod probably, although the ephod was connected to the worship of the priests, but in this case, it's probably a reference to worshiping false gods, but then it has a reference to idols. So not only will they not have a king, not only will they not have a sacrificial system, but they will not engage in idolatry either. In the sense that they did prior to their captivity. So this is one of the things. When the children of Israel came back from the Babylonian captivity, although they still had many issues and problems, they did not worship idols like they had done previously. And even to this day among the Jews, of course, there's an abhorrence of idols. So this is the state of Israel tonight. Many, many days, centuries, millennia, without a king, a prince, a sacrifice, and without the household gods. So that will be how they will remain. But afterward, the Israelites will return to seek the Lord their God. And here's the key, David their king. So David their king here is not David. David's long dead and gone. David their king here is a reference to the Messiah. So we would understand this to be Jesus. They will then, after many days, seek the Lord their God and Jesus their King. They will come trembling to the Lord and to his blessing in the last days. So, and of course, Jesus said this. He said to them, you will not see me again until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. So he indicates you're going to see me again, but not until. And then you think of when the Lord was about to ascend into heaven and the disciples were with him and they said, Lord, you see, they understood that the kingdom would be restored to Israel. That's what they thought was going to happen. And so they said to Jesus, are you at this time going to restore the kingdom to Israel? And Jesus said, it's not for you to know the times or the seasons that the Father has put in his own authority, but you will receive power when the Holy Spirit comes upon you. So Jesus doesn't say, oh no, guys, that's not going to happen. You got it wrong. There is no restoration of the kingdom to Israel. He just simply says, now's not the time. That's in God's hands. Now's the time for you to go and preach the gospel to all of the nations. So they will seek David, their king. And man, when you look at the state of Israel tonight, even, and of course they just came out of this period of war with Hamas, and now they're in political upheaval, and it looks like Netanyahu is finally going to be removed from being the prime minister, and this new coalition government coming in. You know, this kind of stuff just keeps, it's a cycle that repeats itself over and over and over again since 1948 when the Jewish people came back into the land. And it's bound to keep doing that until they say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. So really there is no solution to the problem. The solution is Jesus. And at this present time, Israel is still in that place of not my people, and they are happily not his people because they are very much rejecting the Messiah still to this very day. Somebody was telling me the other day there are 250,000 Jewish believers in Jesus the Messiah that want to make what's called Aliyah. They have a right to Israeli citizenship because they're Jewish. They want to move to Israel. The government absolutely will not let them in because they believe in Jesus. If they were 250,000 Jewish Buddhists or Jewish Hindus or Jewish atheists or whatever else you want to tag onto it, they'd roll out the carpet for them. But because they're believers in Jesus, they are unwelcome. So that's the condition still to this very day. So, chapter 4. And now from chapter 4, I want to go through 7 tonight, but I'm just going to touch on some verses. I'm not going to read all of the verses. If you want to read through them all on your own, that will be great. But I just want to touch on some of the things that are said here. So the fourth chapter is, again, the charge against Israel. Hear the word of the Lord, you Israelites, because the Lord has a charge to bring against you. Why? Because there is no faithfulness, no love, no acknowledgement of God in the land. You know, it's hard to, I mean, think about this. I mean, we look at our own nation and we could say similar things. I mean, obviously there are lots of believers in the country still, thank God for that, lots of churches and so forth. But we know that when it comes to politics and when it comes to just the system of the world, we know there's no place for God in any of that in our nation at all, really. No faithfulness, no love, no acknowledgement of God in the land, for the most part, apart from the church. And we think about that, and I think we all think, gosh, how crazy is that? But think about it, as crazy as it is in the United States of America, think about how crazy it was in Israel. I mean, these people, we have theories. We have theories about the existence of our nation, how it came into existence. A lot of people, you know, the providence of God brought America into being so it could be a light, a city on a hill. You know, there's all of these kinds of theories. They might be right, they might not be right about the founding of the country. But, and whether they're right or not, we're baffled to think, how could the country be so far removed from God? Well, this country here was literally established by God, handpicked, pulled out of Egypt, brought through the Red Sea, and miraculously established in the land. And they have no faith in God. So my point is simply this. Why are we shocked that things are the way they are in the nation that we live in? If the very people of God could come to a place where they had no love, no acknowledgement, no desire to follow God, then why would we think that it would be any different with us? I mean, it's human nature to turn against the Lord. It's human nature to pursue our own will and to shun the will of God. Now, here's a passage that I think many will remember. It's one of the oft-quoted passages from Hosea. Look at verse 6. My people are destroyed from lack of knowledge. How many have heard that passage before? It's a common one. And of course, it's spoken, this is the context, it's spoken to the nation. But it in principle, it's true for everyone, not just for Israel. People are destroyed for lack of knowledge, not knowledge in general, but of course, the reference here is knowledge of God. It's astounding to me where people go when they reject God, personally and collectively. You know, as we see a collective rejection of God in the culture, and look at where things are going. And the direction is really, in the end, if it's not stopped in some way, it will end in destruction. Because when we refuse the knowledge of God, when we refuse to listen to God, when we refuse to take His commands seriously, then inevitably it will be our demise. It will bring anyone down. That's only where it can lead. And so He goes on, because you have rejected knowledge, I also reject you as my priest. Because you have ignored the law of your God, I also will ignore your children. So, again, see, the knowledge is specific. It's the knowledge of God. The priests were the ones who were responsible to teach the people the knowledge of God. And so, because you have rejected knowledge, I also reject you as my priest. And this is something that has always been a reality, that even within the people of God, you have those in positions of leadership who actually reject God and lead people in the rejection of God. Just a week ago, maybe or so, this was so disappointing to say the least, but the Archbishop of Canterbury, he is the head of the Anglican Church, and this particular archbishop claims to be an evangelical, is known as an evangelical. You know, in other words, they have archbishops in the past that were basically atheists. So, you know, here's a guy who claims to believe Jesus, you need to be born again, believes in the scripture, calls people to evangelize, calls people to pray. This is the current archbishop. But he was asked a week ago, he keeps dodging this, but he was asked a week ago, is same-sex sex sin? He could not answer the question. He could not answer the question. Why not? It's not a hard question to answer. We need to answer it wisely, but the Bible's crystal clear about that. But, I mean, here's it's just exactly this thing. The priests, the leaders, sadly, are oftentimes the ones who are compromising and then leading the rest of God's people astray. And so everyone is going to end up being destroyed because of the lack of knowledge, but it starts often at the top. It's sad, and it happens over and over again. Verse 17 is an interesting one here in chapter 4. Ephraim is joined to his idols, leave him alone. Ephraim is the other name for Israel, the northern kingdom. And so God says he's joined to his idols, leave him alone. In other words, there's nothing that can be done any longer. Man, when the Lord says that about somebody, that is not anything anybody ever wants to hear. Leave them alone. That they have so embraced their sin, they've so embraced their idolatry, that there actually is no turning back at this point. That's where Ephraim was. There was nothing that could be done to dissuade them from their course. And so God is basically just saying, I'm done. Now, thank God he suffers long with us. Thank God he continues to track us down. He continues to convict us of sin. He continues to seek to lure us in. He woos us. Sometimes he deals with us. Sometimes he chastens us, but it's all to bring us back in. But when there is that resistance that just becomes sealed in stone, then what can God do? Ephraim is joined to his idols. Leave him alone. Now, the sixth chapter. This is interesting here. And here in chapter 6, let me look at, or let me pick up in verse 14 of chapter 5. So look at verse 14. It says, "For I will be like a lion to Ephraim, and like a great lion to Judah. I will tear them to pieces and go away. I will carry them off with no one to rescue them. Then I will return to my lair," or lair as a lion would, "or I will return to my place until they have borne their guilt and seek my face. In their misery, they will earnestly seek me. So God is saying, I'm going to judge them. I'm going to judge them like I'm going to tear them apart like a lion would. And then I'm going to go back to my place until they have borne their guilt, or another translation is until they admit their guilt. Until they admit their guilt and seek my face. So now, chapter 6 is a continuation. This is now the response of the people to that in the future. But look at what it says. It says, come, let us return to the Lord. He has torn us to pieces, but he will heal us. He has injured us, but he will bind up our wounds. So now this is after the judgment comes. And now the people are saying, let's return to the Lord. But here's where it's really interesting. After 2 days, he will revive us. On the third day, he will restore us that we may live in his presence. Now, this is the mystery. What is the 2 days? What is the 3 days? What is that even referring to? And there's nothing historically that you could point to and say it's talking about 2 or 3 literal days, and there was a point in time, and this is when it happened. So it seems like there's that 2 or 3 days is maybe representative of something other than 2 or 3 literal days. And some have speculated, and I think with good reason, perhaps, that the days are referring to like the days of the Psalms, where a day to the Lord, 1,000 years is a day to the Lord, and a day is 1,000 years. So if you think of it like that, and it might be and it might not be, but if it's not that, then who knows what it is? Nobody knows what it is if it's not that. So we can either go with what it might be, or we can go with absolutely, we don't have a clue what it is. So let's go with this might be it. So after 2 days, he will revive us. So this is the thought. The thought is that the 2 days representing, you know, the 2,000-year period. So that there would be roughly 2,000-year period between the rejection of Jesus by the nation and the restoration of the nation by Jesus when they come, when he comes and they accept him. So if you look at it like that, after 2 days, he will revive us. On the third day, he will restore us that we may live in his presence. So the picture here could be that of after 2,000 years, the Lord coming and restoring the people. And now on the third day, after his return, the third day would be a reference to the next 1,000 years, which would be the millennial kingdom. So maybe that's what it's talking about. We don't really know, but sounds good to me. I mean, I like the idea there that it might be that. And, I mean, that is the picture. The thing is, we don't know. I mean, obviously, we don't know for sure that that's what it means. And we don't know that 2,000 years is the appointed time. I mean, we think it is because we're there. We're 2,000 years out. And it looks like, wow, it looks like things could really, you know, within our generation or maybe the next or something, it looks like everything could finally come to a climax. So because of the way we see things, where we see ourselves at, it seems like this might be the right way to understand it. But again, we can't say for certain because we don't know, but it very well could be. You know, some have said this, and I think there's something to it, that you've got 6 days, and then you've got the seventh day. So in 6 days, the Lord created the heaven and the earth. Seventh day, he rested, right? So some people have taken that and taken a day as 1,000 years and looked at that as basically, you know, seven is the number of completion. So this is the complete cycle of the human experience from the beginning of Adam to the end of the millennial reign of Christ and the beginning of the new heaven and the new earth. So you've got 6,000 years, roughly, of history from the time of Adam, and then you go into the 1,000-year reign of Christ. And so from Adam to Abraham, basically 2,000 years. From Abraham to Christ, 2,000 years. From Christ to today, 2,000 years. And so, you know, give or take. I mean, you can't be precise with these years because, I mean, it's roughly 2,000 years from Adam to Abraham, it seems, looking at the chronology in Scripture. And it's roughly 2,000 years from Abraham to Christ. But again, these are, you know, they're not precise numbers. But, I mean, it does sound like it could be the case. I mean, doesn't that kind of make sense? 6 and 1, God has that pattern. So maybe it's 6 and 1 for not just the beginning of creation, but maybe this is the pattern that God has designated for human history itself. But again, we don't know. So these are interesting things to think about. You just can't be dogmatic about them because, you know, it's just, it doesn't exactly say that. But it could say something like that. And one day we will find out. That's the thing we can say for sure. We will find out one day if we were onto something, or maybe we completely missed it. So after 2 days, he will revive us. On the third day, restore us that we may live in his presence. Let us acknowledge the Lord. Let us press on to acknowledge him. And listen to this. As surely as the sun rises, he will appear. Now, I read this the other day, and I said to Cheryl, I have never seen this verse ever. And then she started singing as surely as the sun will rise. Like, oh, yeah, that sounds like that. But the reason why I've never seen it is because the New King James translates it differently. And so this is the NIV translation. But I thought but isn't that great, though? I mean, just think about it. What a great word. As surely as the sun rises, he will appear. And that's just a great thing to think about. That's a great thing to know. People all worried about life and worried about the world and what's going on and what's going to happen. Hey, I don't know any of that stuff, but this is what I know. As surely as the sun rises, he will appear. It's certain. He's going to come. There's no question about it. So I like that. I'm going to hold on to that translation there. And so a couple more things. What can I do with you, Ephraim? What can I do with you, Judah? Your love is like the morning mist, like the early dew that disappears. That's how their love was. It was temporary. You know, like how you go out in the morning and the grass is wet, the dew on the grass, you know, maybe at 7 o'clock, but you go back out at 11 o'clock and it's gone. It's dried up. That's what God's saying. That's what their love was toward him. And then verse 6, a passage that we're familiar with from the New Testament. For I desire mercy, not sacrifice, and the acknowledgement of God rather than burnt offerings. So they would revert to the ritual and they would try to justify themselves through the ritual. It's like, hey, well, we're offering you sacrifices. But yet they were living completely inconsistently with the way God wanted them to live. And Jesus said this to the Pharisees. He said, I desire mercy, not sacrifice. Remember the Pharisees, they were merciless. They had no mercy on anybody, but they were very rigid about their adherence to the law. So Jesus quotes Hosea to them. Now, chapter 7, and this will be our last one here. We'll just look at just a verse or two here. But again, here we have the reason I'm not reading over this. We've been through the prophets, and the message is pretty much the same thing over and over again. It's God just indicting them and re-indicting them and reminding them of their sins and so forth. And we've seen that. But verse 8 and 9 are the verses that I want to just focus on here. Ephraim mixes with the nations. Ephraim is a flat loaf not turned over. Foreigners sap his strength, but he does not realize it. So the problem was they're mixing with the nations. And it was their love for the other nations and wanting to be like the other nations. It was that was killing them, but they couldn't even see it. You know, I was talking to a friend the other day, and he was telling me about some friends. And this is a guy who recently, in the last several months, God has just really got a hold of his life in an extraordinary way, a powerful way, and delivered him from a lot of stuff. And he's just now, he's at this place where he's so passionate and committed and seeking the Lord, and God's doing a good work in his life. And as a result of that, God's using him to connect with old friends and family members and people. But he was telling me the other day that he was talking to someone, an acquaintance of his, who basically is kind of doing what Ephraim was doing here. He's saying, well, I love the Lord, but he's entangled in all kinds of behavior and activity that God has clearly stated in his word that we're not to be entangled in. But here's the thing. He can't figure out why he's just so miserable all the time. He can't figure out why nothing's working out. Foreigners sap his strength, but he does not even realize what's happening. And that's what happens when we, the people of God, when we embrace the things that God has said for us to not be involved in. It's crazy because, seriously, I can't believe how nuts things have gone so quickly. And here's just an example of what I'm talking about. So a very common thing right now, and any single woman in this room probably knows this by experience, a common thing right now is, I've heard this over and over again. You're asked out on a date by a Christian guy. You go out for dinner or whatever you do. And then there is the question about, well, when can we go to bed? And thinking somehow that, well, that's okay. I mean, if we're going to get married, we've got to make sure we're compatible, and we've got to make sure we're sexually compatible, so we got to go to bed before we get married so we can figure that out, and then maybe we can get married. How is it that we have come to such a backward, distorted way of thinking? And this isn't isolated. This isn't like a couple of, weird people. This is becoming more and more the common experience. So the highly sexualized culture that we live in is now just coming to the church in such a way that sexual immorality is no longer even considered a thing. It's not, everybody does it. It's just the normal thing. And it's exactly what we're talking about here. It's the mixing with the nations. And it's the sapping of the spiritual strength. And nobody even realizes it. Man, I don't know what's going on. I love God, but my life's a mess. But I'm involved in this and I do that. And I know those things are probably not exactly what God would want me to do, but I'm sure he's okay with it. No, he's not okay with it. And we can't keep living that way. Because if we go on and on and on and on and on like that, then inevitably a judgment comes. The judgment is meant to turn us around. But why even press it to that place? I mean, why do that? Why not just say, okay, I want to get things right. So as we see here, unfortunately, Israel is just, they've gone to the point of no return. And they don't even realize what's happened to them. God help us that that doesn't happen to us.